Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, biographers share what it's like to write about other writers. Mary V. Dearborn covers Carson McCullers. George Getchow covers Larry McMurtry. Harold Holzer covers Abraham Lincoln. Monica Zagostova covers Vera Nabokov. Moderated by Peter Coviello. The following conversation originally took place May 19th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Festival.
Our first program today looks at how writers, or biographers, tackle the subject of other writers. We'll look at new works about Carson McCullers, Larry McMurtry, Abraham Lincoln, and Vera Nabokov from writers and scholars. Carson McCullers' biographer, Mary Dearborn, holds a doctorate in English and Comparative Literature from Columbia University, where she was a Mellon Fellow in the Humanities. She is the author of 7 books, among them Mistress of Modernism, The Life of Peggy Guggenheim, and Ernest Hemingway. George Getchow is the editor of a new anthology of essays about Larry McMurtry, Pastures of the Empty Page. George is a Pulitzer finalist, was inducted into the Texas Institute of Letters in 2012, and is the director of the Archer City Writers Workshop. Harold Holzer is the recipient of the 2015 Gilder Lehrman Lincoln Prize, one of the country's leading authorities on Abraham Lincoln and the political culture of the Civil War era. His new book is titled Brought Forth on This Continent, Abraham Lincoln and American Immigration. In A Revolver to Carry at Night, Monica Gustava novelizes the life of Vera and Vladimir Nabokov, researching the remarkable history as a couple and as writers and editors. Monica is also a translator whose own works have been published in 10 languages. Their conversation will be moderated today by University of Illinois at Chicago professor Peter Coviello, whose newest book is titled, Is There God After Prince? Welcome to you all.
All right. Friends, I'm delighted you could be here. Thank you all for coming out on this beautiful Chicago Sunday. We have out-of-town guests, and I'm trying to impress upon them as fully as I can what a gorgeous and a joy-giving city as Chicago is. So they've come at the right weekend. My name is Pete Coviello, and I'm going to moderate this discussion about writing about writers or writing about figures who write. As you heard already, we're speaking rather across modes. We have novels, biographies, collected books, and works of history. And I'd like to speak to our gathered authors about their various approaches to figures who, whatever else they were famously talented writers themselves. So I'd like if we could just go down the road to begin with, if each of you would just tell me a little bit about what brought you to the project that has happily issued in the book that you have out now, and what are some of the things that you encountered along the way that were startling or upending or otherwise redirecting in your purposes? Why don't we start with you, if we could?
Mine was sort of a biographer's dream come true. I always loved Carson McCullers. Since I was about the age of Frankie Adams and Member of the Wedding, which is around 13, and Frankie Adams is one of the great fictional misfits. And that's how I felt at 13, and how I continue to feel, and how I feel now. I think all of us, at some time or other, think we're misfits, and that's partly how Carson relates to you. But I'd read everything about, she'd written, and then I saw a squib in the New York Times Book Review that said it was her 101st birthday, and I said, what happened to the 100th? And then, like predatory biographers do, I said, now, what is there a biography? And I started looking up, and there is a wonderful one from 1975, so it's not, it needed, there, she needed a new one. And I went to, you look up, very, you try to figure out where the person's papers are and whether they're accessible and whether there are papers, because mostly correspondence, because what we do is read other people's mail, and half of them are in Texas, which is pretty common with writers' archives. But then half of them were at Columbus State University in Georgia, which is where Carson was from, and they had just arrived there in 2013 when this woman called Mary Mercer had died at age 101. And the papers weren't processed yet, but they had some things up on the website, and I'm almost done. Among them were Carson had been in therapy in the in the late 50s. Not very many sessions, but for some reason I could explain, she wanted the sessions recorded and transcribed. It made her feel that her words were somehow still hers. And I learned that when Mary Mercer left her papers to Columbus State, to the McCullers archive, that they had the transcripts to the therapy session. And even better, and you can all go see one, the website posted the transcript of a therapy session. And I read that, and for many, many reasons, I was just completely transfixed. And I already felt very lucky that there was room to write about one of my heroines, but that showed me there was going to be a lot of really interesting stuff. So,
right, thank you.
You know, in search of commonalities in our very disparate projects, you reminded me of one. The actress who played Frankie also played Mrs. Lincoln.
That's
Julie
Harris.
We're connected now. I've written a great deal about Lincoln over the last 40 years, and I don't know, I'm always in search of themes that have not been mined particularly. And about 8 or 9 years ago, I proposed exploring Lincoln and immigration. Surely not his principal reason for being in politics and government, but a very important theme to him in the development of his political base, in the fight against slavery because of the German community's deep involvement in the anti-slavery movement, and in the prosecution of the Civil War because of the fact that 500,000 Union soldiers were foreign-born. 23% of the Federal Army in the fight to save the Union were born outside of the United States, and probably another 200,000 were first-generation, hyphenated, first-generation from parents who had come here, principally from Ireland and Germany. I'm the grandson of immigrants. That's one of the reasons I wanted to do it. I wanted to test the waters and see if there was a book there, if there was a study there. And it is a neglected topic because Union and Black freedom are the principal accomplishments of the Lincoln years. Neither would have been possible without the immigrant community. So what I found that surprised me, I guess there were two things. One is that while Lincoln relied on progressive immigrants to help him form the Republican Party and maintain the Union and fight slavery, he also played kind of an unexpectedly cozy game with nativists. He did not want to shun them completely because he thought that they also had anti-slavery principles in addition to hideous bigotry against the foreign-born, particularly Catholics. So he never said a bad word about them. And ironically, that kind of mysterious attitude toward the know-nothings and the nativists might have been what helped Lincoln defeat William H. Seward for the presidential nomination right here in Chicago in 1860. In terms of writing, because we're here to talk about writers, Lincoln was, of course, a brilliant writer in addition to being a very smart politician. He did not always write his finest words about immigration simply because they were off the cuff. But the one phrase, and I'll close this segment with this, that I think is most reverberates the most in terms of our modern confrontation or lack of confrontation or lack of solution of the so-called immigrant problem is what Lincoln said at the Tremont House on Dearborn and Lake Street in 1858, right before the Lincoln-Douglas debate started. He was looking into a crowd celebrating Independence Day, and said, "All praise to the founders and their direct descendants, but I see people in this crowd who are not the descendants of the founders, who have come here from other lands. And the Declaration says that you have as much right to the benefits and the opportunities in this country as the original citizens, that you are the blood of the founding generation." He didn't say that foreigners were poisoning the blood of America. He said they were enriching the blood. And I think that's the bit of writing that stood out to me the most in my pursuit of this subject.
Thank you very much. Monica. Hi, everybody. I'm so happy to be here in Chicago again, which is, it's the city where I studied in Illinois, the University of Illinois, and at the University of Chicago. So it's a pleasure to be back. And it's a city where my parents lived till very recently. And we are talking, you have been talking about immigration, and this is what my novel is speaking about also, you know, actually about exile. My parents were exiles in the United States, and so was I, because they came here when they were over 40, and I was 16, my brother was 15. It was a difficult age. And it was very hard for us. It took us about a year to get accustomed to like the basics of the life in the United States. And while we didn't know any English when we came here, we didn't have any friends. And so it was a very hard experience. And after that, I inflicted the same experience on myself again when I moved from the United States to Spain because I wanted to. And it was really a hard experience, especially the first one, moving to the States, that I have been always writing about people who are exiles. It's like you can find it in almost all my books. I have written also about Stalin's daughter, Svetlana. I have written about Dali's wife, Gala. And about many other people, some of them invented, and some of them who really lived. I have also written about women who were in Russian, who were actually during Soviet times in the Gulag. So that was like a sort of also exile, more like an internal exile, right? So this is like one of my topics, and I usually write about women, so I decided to concentrate more, to focus more on Vera rather than Vladimir Nabokov. And I decided to write a novel because precisely I was just in on such a wave where I was reading a lot by Nabokov, and I read all the biographies of Nabokov and of Vera. So I was like full of their story, and I thought I needed to write a novel which would be writing like not from the outside but from within the person, right? And so that's what I did. And actually it talks about my novel talks about Vladimir, about Vera, about their son Dmitry, and also about some friends, and also one of Nabokov's lovers, because it's an important theme, because he always wrote about love stories. So this is very, very important. But I must also say that I only write about such things that are somehow connected to Vladimir Nabokov's work, because otherwise, it's, for me, it would be gossip, and I'm not that much interested in gossip as to show the readers like what exactly took them, why Nabokov had to write such and such story, and Vera, who was his collaborator, why she also believed in that story, in that novel, or in that short story. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
Hi, I'm George Getchow. I got involved in putting together a collection of stories about Larry McMurtry. I have to take you back to 2005. By the way, I'm originally from Chicago. I'm a wannabe Texan, lived in Texas for 30 years, but nobody accepts me in Texas as a real Texan. Even Larry didn't accept me as a real Texan. He was born and raised there. So I've always been a fan of Larry McMurtry, of his work, both his novels and his nonfiction work. And in 2005, I was a professor, a writing instructor at North Texas State University, which is now the University of North Texas. Larry McMurtry went there he attended there after he flunked out of Rice University. I'll tell you more about that later. But We thought, what better place to go to learn about writing than to the place of one of America's greatest man of letters, Larry McMurtry. He was, and I think will remain for many years, Texas's finest writer and the greatest writer of the American West. How many of you read Lonesome Dove? How many of you read Leaving Cheyenne? How many of you read or watched the movie Last Picture Show? Okay, so you're familiar with his work. So that's why we ended up there. Larry became the muse. At first, he wanted nothing to do with us. He sort of shunned us and said, you know, what the heck are you doing here? This is not a place that I want to start writing, teaching your young writers about writing. But we did a little biography of him, that first class that we had in Archer City, and Larry liked it. So he called me up and said, I'd like to meet you. So I came in and he said, I'd like to be involved in the workshop. So I got to know Larry for 15 years. We were running workshops in his hometown of Archer City. Has anybody been to Archer City? It's this one stoplight town in the middle of nowhere. And that's the place where Larry was born. He was a rancher for the first 18 years of his life, not a rancher, a cowboy, working on his family ranch for the first 18 years of his life. And so he became this famous writer. And who would have expected Larry McMurtry, this cowboy from this godforsaken town in West Texas, to become one of America's greatest writers of Western literature? In fact, he revolutionized Western literature. So we wanted to stand on his shoulders, and fortunately we did. Every year now, ever since we started doing these workshops and Larry participated in the workshops, we'd have writers coming from all over the world who wanted to be a part of it. Why? Not because they wanted anything to do with me. I was a nobody, but Larry McMurtry was somebody. And actually, we've had literally hundreds of writers that have come out of the Archer City Writers Workshop that have been moved by Larry's brand of literature. You know, he was such a special writer, and he could convey how to write. And we learn so much from him as writers. Since we're talking about writers on writing, I just want to say that for me, that's what made Larry so special, is not only was he a great writer, but he was a great teacher. And he taught creative writing at Rice University and TCU and a number of universities early in his career. And so when Larry died in March of 2020, there was no funeral service, there was no memorial, there was nothing. And this was, again, Texas's greatest man of letters. So everybody turned to me and said, George, you've got to do something. So I called together about a dozen prominent writers in Texas, and I asked them whether they would consider writing an essay about Larry and his influence on other writers. And sure enough, I got 12 great writers to write essays, and they all came to Archer City, Larry's hometown, and read their essays aloud at the Royal Theater. There's about 250 people there. They read their essays about Larry, about the mark that Larry left on them, how he shaped them, defined them, changed their perspective on Texas and the American West and all of that. And so it was a powerful evening, an evening of remembrances, an evening of celebration and tribute to Larry, but also of I would say, melancholy. You know, there was this sense that there has to be more. And so afterwards, because of this profound outpouring of sentiment about Larry McMurtry, they said, we've got to do a book. And so I then had to get 38 writers in Texas to write about Larry and Larry's mark on them. And it's part biography, part memoir, part literary criticism. But I'm pretty pleased with the book. I think if you want to find out who Larry McMurtry is, what makes him tick, I think it became a book that is very personal, very intimate, and if you want to know who Larry McMurtry was and will be in the minds of all people that are readers, it's a book worth reading.
Thank you all very much. I wonder if you could each speak about it. As you can gather, we have a fantastically arrayed set of writers of different styles, of different modes, and different periods. And as anybody who's written a book will tell you, like, it's one difficult thing is finding a voice and finding a form. And I was wondering if you could each speak about the relation between your process of finding a voice and finding a form for your particular projects and the fact that you were working with and on people who were themselves such famously powerful writers, whether they were professional writers or not, they were in proximity to writing of great power and lasting force. Now, I'm wondering how that shaped your own approach to the material. Mary, please, yeah.
I'll go in order. I was attracted to my subject first because of her work, but I'm going to be a little, this is a subject on which I'm a little devil's advocate. I make stronger statements than maybe I should. But, for instance, I heard the word gossip here, and I think gossip is part of what we traffic in biography. I remember calling a woman in Italy about Peggy Guggenheim, and she said, Mary, I could tell you all kinds of things, but they'd be gossip. And I'm like, okay. But the point is, I want to know about the life of the person who wrote these books, and specifically what it was about her life that made her write these kinds of books. So for Carson, the obvious thing is that they're all misfits. In her first book, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, written when she was 23, the hero is a gay deaf mute. There's a cross-dresser. There's a black Marxist physician. And I think that you want to look where those characters came from, especially in a 23-year-old Southern woman who was not exposed to anything like that. And it has to come from some feeling that she already had in the early 20s that she didn't fit. And there's a lot of reasons why she, in her life, why she didn't fit. Primarily that she was a lesbian, but she's a Southern and she's a woman. There's a whole array of things. But so I'm not a formalist, and despite I have a background in literary criticism, but I don't really practice that. I don't really want to read that in my biographies, to be perfectly honest. But
an answer that has the virtue of frankness. Yes. Thank you. Please.
Well, I'm writing about a writer who is a political writer. We know Lincoln, or we think we know Lincoln, as a great orator, although it's impossible to imagine his effect on audiences in an era without microphones and speaking before thousands of people. Lincoln wrote his political material with one eye on the reading audience, not just the hearing audience. Everything he wrote for the political platform was meant to be either transcribed or delivered in manuscript form to a newspaper or several newspapers or chains of newspapers, which would publish them for much wider readership than he could possibly reach, even as a peripatetic public speaker. In fact, that's one of the reasons why we don't have any manuscripts of the speeches that Lincoln delivered before his race for, before he became president, or at least president-elect. He didn't have a private secretary. He had no use for manuscripts once they were delivered to a newspaper that would publish them. If the publication got them wrong, as they did, as one did for the House Divided address, it would survive in disorder for generations. That said, the writing is so sublime that in my practice of using the writing, I try to stay away. I try to not over-describe the impact of the words. I think Lincoln does very well, particularly at his finest at Gettysburg or in his second inaugural or his farewell to Springfield in 1861 in speaking beautifully, beautifully for himself and in a literary style that was kind of new. I like to pair him with orators of his period, particularly his longtime rival Stephen Douglas, who died at that same hotel at which Lincoln said blood of the blood, the Tremont House, because there was such a culture of bombastic political writing in the 1850s and 60s, purple newspaper writing as well, that Lincoln's calm, logical writing stands out so distinctly as it, I imagine, it did in his own time. So I'm happy to get out of the way and let him dominate the narrative, which I think he does, even when the subject is immigration. As I say, he did say one quite beautiful thing about immigration, which I say for the end of my book, when he tells Congress that he believes immigration is ordained by Providence, meaning God, not Rhode Island, to replenish a country that had been so broken and so reduced by war, by death, by destruction. And when he spoke about God's will impacting politics, that was very special for Lincoln. As he said in his second inaugural, if God willed that every drop of blood drawn by the lash needed to be repaid by one drawn with the sword, then the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. That's the end of the Lincoln movie, among other things. Same kind of divine will he applies to encouraging immigration, not only legislatively, but rhetorically.
Thank you very much. We're getting at this, the question I really do want to ask, by the way, your relation to the artifacts that are written. Monica, I wonder if you'd say something as a novelist.
Mm-hmm. With pleasure. Well, as I told you, I read at one point of time, I read most of Vladimir Nabokov's works, and as well as his biographies, and there are two. And also Vera Nabokov's biography by Stacy Schiff, which is wonderful. And I was so full of that material, and also I needed to explain certain things to myself, and which I didn't understand even after reading all these things, that I knew, knowing myself, that there was the only way to explain this was to write about it, and I needed to write from inside these people, so I needed to write a novel. So I started writing about Nabokov's old age and his death, and that's like the first chapter of my novel. It's about how he was getting old, how, for example, when he was in Montreux, how he once lost his hat and couldn't run fast enough to get it, and somebody had to help him. And then he thought about like how old age is actually humiliating, right, for him. And so I put this anecdote into my novel. Okay, I'm not sure whether it's true or I invented it. It's possible that I invented it, but nothing is ever invented completely because everything exists already. And we novelists only copy life, right? So when they say this is a true story, all the stories are true, actually. So, and after that, I thought I would just write a longer story, like a novella or something. But then I realized that actually I needed to write a little more. So I wrote also about Vera, who to me was like absolutely mysterious. Even after reading Stacy Schiff's long book, almost 1,000 pages, she was still a mystery to me. So I wrote about her. I didn't know who actually was she. Was she a person who was helping Nabokov in every way, who made a great writer out of him because she knew what to do? He would have been a great writer without her, but he wouldn't have been famous, that's for sure. And she told him to stop writing short stories and poems and concentrate on novels because she knew that novels sell well, and or better than short stories and poems. So was she this like a kind soul who wanted just to help him? Or who was she? Like, what did she do when she found out that he had lovers? And she must have found out, not only, I mean, she did, but she would have found out even if nobody told her, because he wrote about them, and if I can find this out, that he's writing about lovers and not about her, I mean, she must have seen it as well, right? So I found like a woman of many faces. On the one hand, somebody who was helping her husband, but it wasn't only because she was such a great and great soul. It was also because she actually wanted to be a creator. She wanted to dedicate herself to something creative. And she started, when she was very young, she started to translate. But she was very lucid and could see perfectly that she didn't have the gift of creation, because even to be a translator, you have to be a creator, right? To recreate somebody else's world, literary world. And so she could see this, so she realized that she shouldn't do this on her own, and she wanted to be next to somebody who was a great writer and whom she could help. And so she looked around her in Berlin in the 20s, and so she could see that there was only one man, only one writer who was like really, really talented, and that was Vladimir Nabokov, or at that time his pseudonym was Sirin. And so she did what she could to get close to him. It wasn't easy because he was in love with another woman who was a real beauty and she wasn't. And see, we are doing gossips, right? And anyway, so she was very rational, and she did catch him. Let's say it in these words. And so they got married very quickly, and she was with him like all his life, really like helping him very much, like in every way. She was doing everything on the from the literary viewpoint, except for writing for him. But at the same time, when he was already very well known and living in America, which he loved, this was like the country which he liked the most. He loved New York, he loved California, the West Coast in general. But also, well, he was working on the script of his movie, Lolita, with Stanley Kubrick. And there were actresses, famous and beautiful actresses like Marilyn Monroe, who invited the Nabokovs one day to her house for dinner. And so on that very day, there was a phone call from Vera Nabokov. We aren't feeling well, and we aren't coming to your dinner. So that was it. And then after that, Vera took Vladimir to from the cosmopolitan city of New York to the not really cosmopolitan village of Montreux in Switzerland, where there weren't very many beautiful women, and where he could, on the contrary, concentrate on his work. And so that's where they spent the last years of their lives, more than a decade. So I was thinking about this other Vera, whom my publisher from other press, with great pleasure, defined as a perverse woman. I'm not sure if I agree with her completely. I think this is one of her faces only.
Yeah, so my research, I didn't have to go into archives and places like that. What I had to do was reread all of Larry's work. He's written 50 novels, 12 works of nonfiction, 3 memoirs. He wrote 60 screenplays for the big screen, only about a dozen of which were made into movies. Brokeback Mountain, anyone? Okay, we could go on. Last Picture Show was his first movie. But so to reacquaint myself with Larry McMurtry, the writer, versus Larry McMurtry, the man who I knew, we were close friends for 15 years, I felt I had to immerse myself in his own literature and get a sense of what made this guy, this incredible writer who revolutionized writing about the American West. If you recall, you know, Gunsmoke and all the years of, I would say Western literature was comprised mostly of sentimental, romantic notions of cowboy and ranching and life in the American West on the frontier. And Larry, having grown up a cowboy, knew that it was anything but sentimental. He was bucked off his horse in a windstorm one time. He nearly was drowned in the Little Wichita River. He watched a kid decapitated by a drilling rig. He saw the harsh side of what it was like to be a cowboy and live that very tough life on the frontier of Texas, where his grandparents had settled years before and made a life. So I felt it was important for me to get to know this man. What made him tick? What made him so special? And he was also a complicated man, because not only was he a great writer, but he was also a great bibliophile. And I don't know if you know this, but he was one of the greatest collectors of of rare books in the world. He brought 500,000 books to Archer City, and he created this gigantic book barn called Booked Up. He wanted to model his town, Little Archer City, after this Welsh town called Hay-on-Wye. Has anybody been to Hay-on-Wye in Wales? So you know what I'm talking about. Well, that's what Larry was trying to do. He wanted to recreate literature in the greatest book town he wanted to create in America. He failed at it, but he tried. And so one of the things I would do is I spent days in his bookstores just hanging out there, imagining what was going on in his mind, trying to build a Hay-on-Wye. I mean, it's quite a ambitious undertaking to do what he was doing. And it's true of his novels. He always reached far and wide and always pressed, you know, pushed the envelope to try to engage readers in a way they've never been engaged before. And I think that's what made him such a magnificent writer. I would also say that the more I read Larry, the more I realized that we had to sort of compartmentalize his life. So as we built the story around Larry McMurtry, it was Larry McMurtry the cowboy, Larry McMurtry the guy who was found his first box of books came to him when he was during World War II, his introduction to literature, where it began. And then I spent days and days and days just looking at this picture of Larry McMurtry. It's the first picture in my book, Pastors of the Empty Page, where Larry is sitting on his horse, Polecat, and he's 5 years old on this godforsaken ranch, and I thought to myself, how did this cowboy become one of the greatest men of literature of all times? How did it happen? How is it possible? And I went to his ranch, and I hung out at his ranch just days, just thinking about it. How did he do it? So that was my research, and it was insightful to me to sort of resurrect this weird combination of rancher, writer, professor, and how he became what he became. How did it happen? And I spent a lot of time just meditating about it, hanging out at his ranch, hanging out in his bookstores, talking to his siblings. I wanted to find out what made this man the writer that he became. And I feel that thanks to all the people and all the places that I went to, I think I got a pretty good handle on who is Larry McMurtry.
Thank you. For our last, we got 5 minutes, so everyone's have what is a question you can answer in 1 minute. Everybody gets 1 minute to go. It occurs to me as you're talking that a thing that is held in common by these not particularly overlapping writers, and certainly not by writers generally, is they all become famous. Carson McCullers is famous by the time she's 23. Lincoln is obviously very famous. Nabokov, when Lolita hits, becomes an internationally celebrated man. McMurtry, similarly, right? So they're very, it is not an affliction that most writers labor under. Fame, and I wonder if you could just say something very brief about what strikes you about that, any of your given subjects and their encounter with fame or notoriety or something along the way, yeah.
Well, this sounds really, really naive, but one thing, working on Peggy Guggenheim, you might know vaguely the art collector, and she had affairs. She slept with many, many, many artists, and she wrote an autobiography, and she names most of these and writes about them. And people say, oh, she's such a name dropper. It's so awful. But the important thing, and this isn't nothing, including Samuel Beckett, she writes about, is they weren't famous yet. They're just some other guy. It's like when I was in college and slept with some artist, excuse me. But it's important. And Carson, I think the whole thing about fame, she got famous very early, and it was very heady. And she said, I was a bit of a holy terror, and it was kind of a curse. But generally, they're just living their lives and going on into at their desks every morning, and it's kind of the last thing on their minds, in my case. Yeah.
Well, Lincoln always wanted to be famous from the time he was a young adult, but at 21, he was living with his parents in on the prairie. He didn't even leave his father's house until he was 22, and he was not famous in his early days. He was a struggling legislator. But his voice could be seen in the writing, and that's what appealed to people. But I would suggest, and I try to demonstrate in my immigration book, that Lincoln doesn't really grasp the totality of his opportunity and his ability until he spreads his wings and begins visiting places like Chicago, which is the place where the most important newspaper is published. He walks into the Tribune and says, I want to take your paper. I have some money. And they say, who is this guy in blue jeans? It was just like, come into the office. We don't even know who he is. That remark about flesh of the flesh and blood of the blood, the status that immigrants should have, spoken in Chicago, was motivated because he had failed to go to a German picnic in Chicago on July 4th. A missed opportunity creates another opportunity, but it only happened when he began spreading his wings and traveling throughout Illinois. So he's kind of a late bloomer in politics.
That's great. Thank you.
Well, Nabokov wasn't, I don't think he was really concerned about getting famous or becoming famous or anything like that, but Vera was. And they didn't have much money, which actually Nabokov, who was a noble from the Russian nobility and all that, he wasn't really concerned with money. It wasn't like his topic, but Vera was. And the topic of Lolita was always like kind of in his head. In a minute, I will tell you why. And Vera was, she insisted that he write about it, okay? So it was very hard for him not only to write about it, but to write that novel. He wanted to burn it several times, and Vera always saved the novel. She always said, like, we are going to keep this. And it was because he was writing it in English, because he couldn't write it in the language which he knew so well, which was Russian, right, his native tongue. He had to switch into English because of Vera, because Vera wanted him to write a novel with a striking topic and in English. And so he did, after many scandals and many difficulties, he did become famous. But let me tell you, I just want to tell you very briefly, because this, I could talk about it for an hour or more, but actually I found out who Lolita was. Lolita actually was somebody very different than we think. Why did Nabokov need so badly to write about Lolita? Because he was Lolita. Because actually, when he was a boy, when he was 12 years old, he had his uncle, who was homosexual, was abusing of him. So he had this for many years inside, had like many problems with this topic and needed to write about it. So he wrote A Sorcerer, which is about this topic, but he wasn't happy with it. And so he wrote Lolita, which finally, after many, many great effort, he was happy with it. It was, as I said, a great scandal, but at the same time, it is very interesting. This is something that I found out after doing so much research for my book, that actually he wrote about himself.
How did Larry McMurtry become famous? Well, he wrote 52 short stories when he was at the University of North Texas, where I taught. He thought they were so bad that he burned them. But he resurrected two of those short stories before burning them. He saved them, put them aside. One was about a venerable rancher, and the other was about a diseased cattle herd. And he melded those two stories together to write the book Horsemen Pass By, his first book. And that book was turned into a movie immediately starring, has anybody seen the movie, HUD?
Yeah.
Horsemen Pass By, so you know what I'm talking about. That sort of set him up, his literary career. But I think what's interesting is that even with the success of his early novels, Larry always felt that he was nothing more than a minor regional writer. In fact, he had t-shirts made up that he used to wear around. He'd go to festivals and stuff, and he had this shirt say, a minor regional writer. And he really believed that. Because when he put himself in, you know, in the shoes of all the great, great writers of the universe, he felt he was and will always remain such. And yet, I think privately, fame meant something to him. The fact that people were reading his work meant something to him. The fact that people would come to his bookstores from all over the world meant something to him. And yet he had this view that he was and will always remain a minor regional writer. And one of the reasons why I think this is important to bear in mind is that my job, I see as being his literary torchbearer. What I'm doing is creating a literary center, a writing center in Archer City that will memorialize and hopefully perpetuate his work forever and ever. So many writers, famous writers, are lost in history. You know, even Shakespeare would have been lost if it weren't for his students who resurrected, you know, his folios and his theater and all of that. So I think part of fame is who is going to be the torchbearer to carry on the work of the famous writers. And in Larry's case, I feel he deserves the attention, world-class attention. I think he's a world-class writer. And so we're working really hard right now to create a permanent writing center in Archer City that will memorialize his life, his work, his book collecting, and all of that. So maybe someday you can come to Archer City and see which will embody Larry's work. I hope you'll come to see it.
Thank you. What a perfect way to summarize. I would remind you all that Elizabeth Bishop, one of the great poets in English of the 20th century, described herself as a minor female Wordsworth. Yeah. Two things. I would invite you to meet the authors and buy their books out here, which you can do momentarily. And I would also invite you to thank them all for their conversation today.
Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.